It's the longest continuous story in the Torah, the story of Joseph. And in order to illustrate one theme that runs through it, I'm going to tell you the story in about 60 seconds. I'm leaving out a little bit. It took Thomas Mann some 2,000 pages, but you'll get the essence of the story in order to make the point. Joseph is the favorite son. He has dreams that all of his brothers and his parents bow down to him. Now, I don't know about you. I grew up with three brothers. When someone did something that offended you, you beat them up, right? That was the accepted mode. Maybe you broke a favorite toy, something. You blamed something on them they weren't really responsible for. But at least in my family, selling into slavery was thought of as over the line. So, in Philadelphia, there wasn't a large slave trade, but that's beside the point. Nonetheless, Joseph's brothers first, and by the way, they sell him into slavery, you know, as a compromise, right? They're going to kill him, but in the end, they only sell him into slavery because ethics prevailed. So, he gets sold into slavery as a result of these dreams and this hubris and his obnoxiousness towards them. In Egypt, through various events, he gets thrown into the jail. There, he makes his name as a dream interpreter. He gets out by interpreting the dreams of Pharaoh. He becomes the vizier, the second in command to Pharaoh in Egypt. His brothers, who remember are really his half-brothers, that is, they're his father's children but not his mother's children. His mother is Rachel. They all come to Egypt because there's a famine in Israel, which is a recurring motif in the Bible. They come before him. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. He wants to see his one full brother, Benjamin, whom they left at home. Judah says, we can't bring Benjamin here because if we bring Benjamin here, it's going to kill our father because he's worried now about losing the only other child of Rachel. Joseph works it so that in the end, they have to bring Benjamin. They bring him. He reveals himself, there's a reconciliation, and then he brings his children as a sort of nice final scene for his father, who long ago thought he had died, or maybe thought he had died, at least thought he would never see him again. He brings his children for his father to bless, and his father, in what seems to be a mistake but turns out to be deliberate, blesses the younger child with his right hand and the older child with his left. Then, in the end, he blesses all the children, and Genesis is over. Okay? That's the story. Abbreviated. Now, I want to highlight three separate aspects of that story because they all teach the difference between selfish love and unselfish love. And that is one of the leitmotifs. That is one of the things that threads itself through the Joseph story. I don't want to say that that's what the Joseph story is about, because it's too complicated and rich and beautiful and nuanced a story to be about one thing. You can't pin a moral at the end, like you can with Aesop's fables, and say, you know, this is about slow and steady wins the race. It's about many things, but it clearly is about the difference between selfless and selfish love. Let's take Joseph first, then Judah, and then Jacob. Joseph is self-involved when he is young. He is a narcissist. He listens only to his own dreams. I mean, who but somebody who was self-involved would go to his siblings and his parents and say, I dreamt you all bow down to me. And not only do it once, but do it twice. You could imagine some naive and foolish kid sitting around the breakfast table and said, I had a dream that you bowed down to me. But once he saw the reactions on the faces of his siblings and his parents, you would assume that he would think to himself, should I have that dream again, I'm going to keep quiet about it, right? I'll tell my friends at school, but I won't mention it at home. But the Torah emphasizes that Joseph did it twice, which lets us know that he was in this bubble of self-involvement and could not see other people. And then, of course, he has this very traumatic and difficult experience of, first of all, realizing how much his brothers hate him. Because while he was in the pit, before he was sold into slavery, what must he have been thinking about? How terrible they were, for sure. But at a certain point, when someone treats you that badly, it must strike you that they really hate you. And these are his brothers, after all. And he doesn't even know if his father is involved in this or not, because it's his father who sends him out to find his brothers. So Joseph has what I assume is a shattering experience, which is the realization that while he may think of himself as very special, the people around him can't stand him. And he doesn't have a chance to reconcile with them because he's sold into slavery and then into jail. Now, here's somebody who knows dreams, but he only knows his own dreams. And then, all of a sudden, the baker and the cupbearer come to him and say, "We've had dreams." And there's a transition in Joseph, because he becomes someone who can only listen to his own dreams, or from someone who can only listen to his own dreams, into somebody who can listen to the dreams of others. And once he does that, there is the opposite movement in the story. There's been a gradual descent into a pit, and now there is an ascent out of jail. Now he moves up and up and up the ladder because he has learned selflessly to care for others, to listen to the dreams. After all, the cupbearer, the baker, he doesn't only give them good interpretations. There's a certain selflessness in his interpretations of their dreams that brings him to the side of Pharaoh. So Joseph is the first one to learn that there is a difference in selfish love and selfless love, and that listening to the dreams of others, paradoxically, is a way to make your own dreams come true. Because that's what happens. In the end, his brothers bow down to him because he has learned to listen to the dreams of Pharaoh. The second part of this is the story of Judah, or the story of the brothers. Remember what Judah says to him when he says, "I want you to bring this other brother"? He doesn't say, "Bring my brother Benjamin," because he hasn't yet revealed himself. When he says to Judah, "Bring the other brother," Judah says, "I can't. It will kill our father." Now, this marks a radical change. When he threw Joseph into the pit, he was consumed only by his hatred of Joseph. He didn't throw Joseph into the pit and think, "Oh my God, what's this going to do to our father?" In fact, he emphatically didn't think that, because what did the brothers do? They brought Joseph's bloody tunic and said he was killed by a beast. So they not only sold their brother into slavery, but they callously brought home this evidence that he was torn to pieces and said to our father, "Look, he's dead." But now Judah has watched years and years of his father suffering for his lost son. And he begins to realize that anything you do in a system, in a family system, in a community, anything you do affects everyone. And so now he realizes that he can't bring Benjamin, even though it would be good for him, because it would hurt his father. And he too has moved from selfish love, that is, only caring about himself and his brothers and getting rid of this thorn in his side, to selfless love, which is loving his father so much that he can't stand to hurt him again. And then Jacob and Joseph are reconciled, and everybody is together. And Joseph brings his two children, the older one Manasseh and the younger one Ephraim, and says to his father, "Bless them." Now, in order to understand the drama of this scene, you have to remember a little bit of your history of Genesis, which is, in a word, brothers don't get along. They never get along. Just think Cain and Abel, right? It starts the first pair of siblings in the Bible, and one of them kills the other. Then you go on Isaac and Ishmael. One of them gets thrown out of the house, right? Jacob and Esau. What does Jacob do when he's young? He steals his brother's birthright and then runs away so his brother doesn't kill him. So we know that younger brothers usurp the place of older brothers, and older brothers want to kill them for it, right? Joseph is just the last example. Joseph is the younger brother who's favored. His older brothers want to kill him. Goes back to Jacob and Esau, Isaac and Ishmael, Cain and Abel, and now we've got Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob, who is old and blind and is blessing his grandchildren, puts his right hand on the younger and his left hand on the older. And Joseph, who knows this history and knows this is not a good idea to favor the younger instead of the older, says, no, 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 Dad, you know, you're a little old, you're a little confused, you didn't grow up here, you don't really know my kids, switch your hands, I'm elaborating a bit, switch your hands, you have the right hand on the younger and the left hand on the older. And Jacob says essentially, be quiet, I know what I'm doing. And he blesses Ephraim first. And then, in some ways, the most remarkable silent moment of the Torah happens, right? Because sometimes remarkable things are signaled by a lot of noise and fury, but then there are times, like the famous Sherlock Holmes story, where he says to Watson, did you notice what the dog did in the night? And Watson says, the dog didn't do anything. The dog didn't bark. And Holmes says, that's the point, right? Sometimes it's the dog that doesn't bark that tells you what the point is. Menashe says nothing. He doesn't say, how could you bless my younger brother before me? He doesn't say to Ephraim, I'm going to kill you because you got the blessing. In other words, after all this long story, Menashe models selfless love. He doesn't have to get the firstborn blessing because he loves his brother. Something that we haven't seen in all the stories of the Bible, but it lets you know that now, having finally gotten it right, and God knows it took a long time, having finally gotten it right, Israel is ready to become a people because they've worked out that you cannot become a people if you care only for yourself. That you have to be able to love someone else not only for what it gives you, but for what it gives them. That ultimately, this act of self-transcendence, that is overcoming yourself, is what allows you to tie yourself to someone else. It's the message of family. It's the message of community. And ultimately, it will be the message of the people Israel. Because if they don't take care of one another, they'll never make it through the wilderness. And they'll never make it through all the many wildernesses of our subsequent history. And the story of Joseph is a preparation for that. It lets us know that while it is possible to love only yourself, it's even done sometimes, while it is possible, it is ultimately destructive, not only of others, but even of the individual who loves only himself. Joseph learns that. And maybe that's one of the reasons why, in our tradition, he's called Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the Righteous One. Because he doesn't start out that way. He starts out as the golden child, but he has to understand as he grows that you can't be the only golden one. That ultimately everybody has to be embraced in that. And when we finally finish the book of Bereishit, and we finally finish the book of Genesis, and we say Chazak, Chazak, V'nit Chazek, strong, strong, and may we all be strengthened. Notice we put it in the plural. We don't say strong, strong, and may I be strengthened, but may we all be strengthened, as we will be if we learn, understand, and absorb the message of Joseph, his children, his parents, and his brothers, which is that selfish love alone destroys, and selfless love together elevates us all. Shabbat Shalom.